to our father. Some men trust in horses, but we're going to trust in the name of the Lord our God. Amen. Regardless of tomorrow or late tonight, it won't matter. We didn't plan it, but I don't think we could have planned better to have tonight be what tonight is on this occasion. None of us were looking at the calendar. We just said, let's pick two Tuesday nights in the fall and let's do this. Then we looked at each other and said, do you know what November 7th is? Or is it the 8th? See, we're supposed to be here last night. That's the problem. No, just teasing. All right. Dr. Tony Evans is the founder and pastor of the Oak Cliff Bible Fellowship. He's a graduate. He has the distinction of being the first African-American graduate with a doctoral degree from Dallas Seminary. And we're proud of that. He has served as an associate professor in our pastoral ministries department in the areas of evangelism, homiletics, black church studies. He's the founder and president of the Urban Alternative, former chaplain of the NFL Cowboys, present chaplain of the Dallas Mavericks. His radio broadcast, The Alternative, with Tony Evans, can be heard on nearly 1,000 U.S. radio stations and in more than 130 countries, which lets you know the ministry of the word transcends to the state of Texas, Oak Cliff Bible Fellowship, the U.S., its truth, its God's truth, and it's worldwide applicable. Dr. Evans has been married to Lois, his beloved wife, ministry partner for over 40 years. They're the proud parents of four, the grandparents of 12, and though he's way too young, he's the great-grandparent of one. They are. It's a privilege to call him a friend, board member for Dallas Theological Seminary, a very helpful partner in counsel. And thank you, Tony, for taking the time out to be with us in our chapel time tonight. Would you join me in welcoming Dr. Tony Evans?
Good evening. Can't believe they picked this date to ask me to speak. I believe they did it on purpose. This is called white on black crime. They would do that. No, the invitation was short and sweet. The president called me if I asked if I believed in free speech. I said yes. He said, come get one. So that was at the heart of it. In all seriousness, I am very grateful to be here. Any opportunity that I have to come to this campus is one of highest honor for me. Every time I step foot on this campus, for whatever the reason, my mind goes back to 1972 when I had the privilege of becoming a student here and having my worldview shaped, having a theological foundation poured, and having a ministry philosophy hewed out of my time here, developing during those great years some magnificent friendships, like my friendship with Ramesh Richard and others who we have come to love and appreciate, and we still benefit from our relationship with this school. And so it is an honor to be able to be here, to have two of my children who have graduated from the school and another one who is now attending. So it's quite an honor. It was stated that I spent a number of years as chaplain of the Dallas Cowboys when my son, Jonathan Evans, who's a graduate of the seminary, finished his brief NFL career and then came and graduated from seminary. He took my place and is currently the chaplain for the team. He does the Bible studies for the team, does the chapels for the team, travels with the team, and carries on a great ministry with the players. All of you who know football and love football know that when there is a football game, three teams take the field. There is the home team in Dallas, of course, that's the Dallas Cowboys. And then there is the visiting team, this week, the Pittsburgh Steelers. And that means that there is going to be 3 hours of non-negotiable conflict. This conflict will occur because these two teams will automatically be at odds with each other. Because they're headed in two different directions. There is a goal line here and a goal line there, and their job for the better part of 3 hours is to interfere with the other's progress. Nothing you can do can stop the war. It's the nature of the field on which they have gathered. But in the midst of these two teams has been inserted a third team. It's the team of officials. These are made up of the 9 officials whose job it is to be on the field, but not of the field. Their role is to be in the middle of the conflict without becoming a part of the conflict. You see, they have been deputized from 345 Park Avenue in New York by the Commissioner Roger Goodell to represent the kingdom up there and the chaos down here. They have been deputized to be on the field, and while they will not stop the conflict, they are to make it manageable by their mere presence. Each one of these 9 officials has been given a book. This book, coming from the offices in New York, given to every official on the field, is designed to give them the governing guidelines by which all decisions are to be made on the field of play. You see, each official understands that his personal opinion must be subject to that book. He understands that his inclinations must be adjusted to the book he has received from the kingdom in New York. He understands that this will not be a popularity contest because sometimes they know they will be booed by at least one of the teams and the hometown crowd if it goes against the hometown team. They know other times they're going to be cheered. But they also know that they're not there for the applause of the crowd. They're there to render decisions in the middle of the chaos based on the book that they've been given from the kingdom of which they have emanated from in the chaos that they find themselves. These officials are very distinguishable. You will never have to guess who they are. They wear black and white jerseys. They do not don the jerseys of the competing teams because they don't belong to them. Now, to be sure, they are grossly outnumbered. There are 53 players on each team. There is the coaching staff of each team. And then there are thousands of people in the stands. And there are just 9 of them. But they understand that even though the players are younger, stronger, and faster, and they are older, fatter, and slower, they clearly understand that while the players have power, they carry authority. Because they have a yellow flag and a whistle. Oh, to be sure, the players can knock you down, the refs can put you out. Because they carry kingdom authority. You need to understand that you and I are God's officiating crew in a world of conflict. There is cultural conflict, racial conflict, police and citizenry conflict. There is Democrat and Republican conflict. And the clashes just keep on coming. That is the world in which you live, raise a family, and do ministry. That is the world in which God has placed you and me. He's given each of us a book. It's the same rule book. And he intends for all the decisions on the field of play by his officiating crew to be consistent with that book. A few years ago, the NFL officials went on strike. They went on strike. They sent in replacement officials. There was chaos on the field. Because the replacement officials didn't know the book. And so they were giving their opinions rather than ruling by authority from above. If there's one thing that Dallas Seminary did for me above all else, was to give me a view of an inerrant document that carried with it kingdom authority. And you and I have to understand why you matter now, Christ be not come, more than ever before. Because only you and I understand what's really going on in the conflicts that we've been called into the midst of. 2 Chronicles chapter 15, verses 3 to 6 puts it this way. In those days, there was no true God, no teaching priest, and no law. It goes on to say, there was no peace to him who went in or to him who went out. It says, city rose up against city, and nation rose up against nation. In other words, cultural chaos. But then verse 6 ends with this word. It says, for God troubled them with every kind of distress. Personal conflict, family conflict, urban conflict, international conflict. But the cause of the conflict, we are told, is not that the devil made them do it. We're told that God troubled them with every kind of distress. Now, if God is your problem, only God is your solution. If God is the cause, only God is the cure. You see, what you are seeing on news every day and in the papers every day is a country and a culture experiencing what I call the passive wrath of God. In the Old Testament economy, it is plagued with the active wrath of God. Fire and brimstone falling from heaven, the earth opening up, the flood pouring down, where God directly brings judgment on a people, a culture, or a person. But the death of Christ in history greatly adjusted how God could relate to the world. For through the death of Christ, 2 Corinthians 5 says that God reconciled the world to himself. And so the world got repostured by Christ's death so God could relate to it differently. So now what the world normally experiences is not the active wrath of God that we regularly see in the Old Testament, but the passive wrath of God described in Romans chapter 1, verses 24, 26, and 28, when God says, and he turned them over, and he turned them over, and he turned them over. That is, he abandoned them to experience life without him. What you are seeing today is what it looks like when a people have been abandoned by God. Because God has been put on the periphery of the life, of the family, of the culture. Some time ago, my wife asked me to go to Walmart to get some things for her. And you have to understand, I hate anything with Mart in its name. If Mart is in its name, I'm not interested in it. But on this particular Saturday, she had too many other things to do. And so I agreed to go to Walmart to get what she needed. I wanted to be there as soon as the doors opened. I wanted to be the first one in and the first one out. When I got there, the rest of Dallas had beaten me there. The parking lot was jam-packed with cars. I'm wondering, how could all these people be here this early? I went in, got my goods, stood in this long line, trying to figure out, how could these people be here this early? Come to find out, this Walmart was having a store-wide sale. See, everybody had shown up to get their goods at reduced prices, and it dawned on me, yep, that's what's wrong. Everybody wants God. They just want him on sale. As long as they can get God cheap, they'll shop there. The moment he comes at full price, they'll shop elsewhere. See, people do not want the God of the Bible. They want the God that they control, better known in Scripture as idolatry. The God that you control. But the reason why the passive wrath of God was there in the New Testament, and as it is stated that he was the cause of the crisis in 2 Chronicles chapter 15, it goes on to say, because during those days there was no true God. Now, it didn't say there was no religion. It didn't say people didn't still go to temple or what we would call today church. But the God of the Bible and the God that they were dealing with was not the same person. God had been dumbed down to be a glorified man. Homocracy had replaced theocracy. The rule of man had replaced the rule of God. The attempt to build culture and civilization, Babel, was now being erected in society. And so there was no true God while there was plenty of religion. It says the second thing that was wrong, that was really responsible for the first thing, verse 3 says, is that there was no teaching priest. The pulpits had preachers, but they weren't saying much of anything. You see, a mist in the pulpit is a fog in the pew. When pulpits are weak, and then members become weak, then referees fail to call the right plays. The reason why there is a racial divide in the country is because 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is still the most segregated hour. The reason why the culture is in disarray is that the officials can't get together and make a unified call. And it is the absence of teaching priest that was developing a constituency of kingdom citizens that was led to a culture without the true God, resulting in what verse 3 calls the absence of law. That is, people were making up their own rules. In other words, postmodernism, where you have no absolutes except that which you call absolute because it's absolutely true for you. And so as a result of this divine dismissal, as a result of the marginalization of God, the weakness, how can we have all these churches on all these corners with all these preachers and all these members and still have all this mess? There's a dead monkey on the line somewhere. And that is because there is pulpits that are satisfied to give words about God rather than the authoritative voice of God. We do not believe that God has spoken and that he has not stuttered, that there are two answers for every question, God's answer and everybody else's, and everybody else is wrong. And who speak it with authority and who are not wimps. Because this is not a time for weak pulpiteers. This is not a time for weak church leadership, because the teams are at war. And they're not going to stop fighting. And God has always said, you know, that Sodom and Gomorrah would still be on the map if Abraham could have found 10. Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed not only because the sinners were sinning. Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed because the righteous couldn't be located. Now, he had a righteous preacher in town named Lot, but he suffered from the American disease of personal peace and affluence. He had a family, but when it was time to get out of Dodge, his two sons-in-laws didn't believe him. His wife remembered Neiman Marcus and Saks, and she turned back into a pillar of salt. two daughters had an incestuous relationship with his father. I mean, if he would have just won his family, that would have made six. If each one of them would have won one, that would have made 12. Abraham would have found 10, and Sodom and Gomorrah would still be on the map. See, when God's people can't be located, Dallas-Fort Worth is in trouble. The culture collapses. I know what you say. We're dispensationalists here at Dallas Seminary, and we're waiting for the imminent, any moment return. Why should we care? Why should we worry about this, since we know the Bible declares that things are going to get worse and worse? Same reason you jog, even though you know you're going to die. You don't use the reality of death as an excuse for inertia. No, that's why he says in verse 4, he says, in their distress, they called on him. In their distress, they called on him. That's the same statement that's made about what God caused in verse 6. In verse 6, it says, he caused distress. In verse 4, it says, in their distress, the thing he caused, they called on him. And he let them find him. He put them in a position that only he could fix. And the way it is now in our culture, in the redefinition of the family, in the taking of the lives of the unborn, in the racial strife, and you name the issue, God caused it. And when you understand God causes it, then you have to understand only God can fix it. And make no mistake about it, my brothers and sisters, God is not going to skip the church house to fix the White House. He's not going to bypass his people. Ephesians 3:10, God checks with the church before he deals with the principalities and the powers and the rulers. And until he discovers that the church is ready to act and rule on his behalf, then the culture deteriorates because the referees are more interested in being popular than being principled. So this is not a time merely to just learn great theology, as foundationally important that is. But this is a time for men and women of God to rise up and to bring God unapologetically and definitively into the public square. This is not a time for secret agent Christians and spiritual CIA representatives. God is not looking for covert operatives. Everybody else is coming out the closet. You might as well come out too. You and I will all go back to our televisions tonight, and we will look at the returns as they come in. And for years now, people have unapologetically come out for the person that they want to rule in America. It's on their lawns, it's on their cars, it's discussed around water coolers because they're passionate about the candidate to be president. Unapologetically willing to risk scorn by the opposing team because they're committed to the one they believe in. Well, if we're really committed to the Lordship of Jesus Christ, if we're committed to the fact that he alone is King of Kings and Lord of Lords, if we are committed to his death, his resurrection, his ascension, and his ruling from the right-hand side of his Father, if we are committed to the fact that he lays claim to authority, not only in the sweet by and by, but also in the nasty here and now. When you understand that he has authority, ecousia, over heaven and earth, legitimate right to rule, You don't come at this as a weakling. You come at this with kingdom authority. I call it having a kingdom agenda, the visible manifestation of the comprehensive rule of God over every area of life. Officials don't come just because they're outnumbered on a field and make suggestions. They don't come just because they're going to be booed to ask everybody, what do you think? They come because they've got a definitive word from New York. And that definitive word is to be made in the midst of a conflict, because they know they carry kingdom authority. In fact, I like how Jesus put it when he spoke to Peter about the church. He said, I'm going to give you the keys to the kingdom. There's a thing that we've missed about the ecclesia, the new covenant. You see, way back in the old covenant, God told Israel, look, I'm going to give you laws. Deuteronomy chapter 4. I'm going to tell you how the world works from God down to you. But you're not to keep this to yourself. I want you to be so visible with how I work with you, to you, and through you, that the other nations of the world will see you and say, what manner of people is this with a God like that? That they would see the covenant of God at work and be envious of it, even though they were not part of it. All through Scripture, we are told about the role of God's people, not only in influencing God's people, but influencing the environment in which they lived. It would be Daniel who would influence the environment of a Babylonian pagan. It would be Esther who would influence the environment of her Persian husband over and over again. It would be the righteous that would affect the environment and who would shape the atmosphere. And so he says of his church, the ecclesia, what we've missed is we've defined the church, we've dumbed it down. We've dumbed it down to be a 1.5 hour gathering weekly. Well, that's if you're white. If you're black, 2.5 hour gathering weekly. For inspiration, information, fellowship, all that's great. But if you were walking up and down the streets of Rome under a Hellenized environment under Greek influence, where they spoke Koine, common everyday Greek, you would have heard the word ecclesia. It would have been part of regular discourse, because it's not a unique Christian word. Because the ecclesia was regularly and normatively used of a legal gathering, a city council, a congress, some legal body that had gathered to pass laws. It was a legal gathering. The word means called out ones, but the question is called out from what, for what, to what? Well, it was called out of the general population in order to execute legal instruction on behalf of the populace. They were the legislators. That was the gathering or the assembly of the ecclesia. It's used that way in Acts chapter 19. In Acts chapter 19, verse 39 and verse 41, he says the assembly gathered, get this, to pass laws against the church. But he uses the Greek word ecclesia twice, because the ecclesia was a legislative body. Jesus grabs that word, sanctifies it, and says, I will build my ecclesia, my legal gathering. It is the job of the church to legislate from heaven to history. We're to be God's embassy. An embassy is a small replication that represents a bigger nation. We are embassies on earth that reflects the value systems of heaven located in history. He says, I will give to you, and only you, because nobody else has it, the keys to the kingdom. You ever been in a hurry and not been able to find your keys? Or maybe you're like me, you got keys on your key ring and you don't even know what some of them go to. So they become useless keys. Well, I was in New York and I was at the Marriott Marquis. And I had to leave, check out, and fly to Chicago to the Hilton Hotel. Checked in, went up 35 floors in the dead of winter, put my key in the lock, click, click, red light, click, click, red light, click, click, red light. Well, right now, I'm evangelically ticked off. I've got all this luggage. I done gone all the way up, and now I got to go all the way down and tell this guy, this key does not work. He said, excuse me, sir, that key doesn't go to this hotel. I was trying to put my Marriott key that I didn't throw away in a Hilton lock, and those kingdoms don't mix. What we often find in churches today is they don't legislate from heaven. What they do is bring to the church the world's point of view. Say a little prayer over it and think it's endorsed by Jesus. He says, no, I'm going to give you the keys to the kingdom, and you'll know when you have those keys, because whatsoever you bind on earth, you will be bound. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. That's allowing or forbidding. You will carry the authority. So why don't we have more authority? Is it just because the devil is just running crazy? No. It's because we don't recognize our legal authority. And we've settled for inspirational weekly meetings. If Christ comes tomorrow, we don't have to worry about any of this. If he doesn't come back for another 100 or 200 years, you better worry about all of this. It's your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren. Now, they're going to grow up in some kind of world. So it will either be one influenced by the kingdom of God or controlled by the kingdom of darkness. And the fact that we're outnumbered is irrelevant. Because when the referees step on the field, they control the agenda. And it is with that mindset I challenge you to go into whatever ministry God calls you into. With the mindset that I am a representative of the King, and therefore I carry kingdom authority. I don't just do kingdom ministry. Yes, I do that. But I do kingdom ministry with kingdom authority. And that's how I view me. That's how you are to view you. That's how we are to view God's church, because it is God who has caused all the despair until he gets the undivided attention of his people. A gentleman one day was on his way to his honeymoon with his lovely bride. They were traveling on this country road to their first evening together as a married couple. But it was a foggy evening. They were behind a truck, a fairly good-sized truck, and the husband wanted to pass the truck. They pulled out to pass the truck, but he didn't see the oncoming van. It would be a head-on collision. The collision was so hard that it popped his car and flipped it over, and both he and his wife were knocked unconscious. He came to first. He looked over to the passenger side and saw his wife, his brand new bride, gushing with blood. He knew he had to do something quickly because she would bleed out and die. But what could he do? He's on this country isolated road. But that's when he saw it. As fortune would have it, there was a sign on the hill right in front of him that said, Office of Dr. Bill Jones. How fortunate could it be that this catastrophe happened in front of a doctor's office? He quickly staggered around to the passenger side, opened the door, grabbed his bleeding bride, walked up the hill to the house, knocked on the door. An old man came to the door. The old man said, "What can I do for you?" He said, save her. She's dying. Please, please, save her. The old man looked at the young man holding his bleeding bride and said, I am so sorry. I stopped practicing years ago. To which the young man said, Mister, you have two choices. Save her. or take down your sign. But don't have a sign that gives me the impression that if I show up, you can turn things around. Don't have a sign that makes it look like if I show up, you can make things better. Don't have a sign that advertises that when we show up here, things are gonna be different. But when we show up, nothing happens. There is a bleeding world in every single category. So as you study and learn and prepare, you have two choices. Be kingdom citizens that unapologetically represent the king, or take down your sign.